associated with the Center for Water and Water Studies out of Water Center. And she looked at nutrient cycling in small streams down the Olympic Peninsula, they're looking at the effects in there all that. And then she, after graduating, worked as a postdoc with NOAA Fisheries over here at Bonnet Lake, working on designing long-term monitoring programs for salmonid ecosystems. And she's part of a group called the Integrated Status and Effective Monitoring Program, ISEFE. And now she consults, consulting with NOAA Fisheries and Bonneville Power Administration. It's a continuation of those projects, and I guess that's what we're going to hear about today. So, data, and more data.
Thanks, Bob. And thanks for having me here today. It's been a long time since I've been back at the college. Can you guys hear me all right in the back? Yeah? Okay. So today I'm here to talk about data. I'm going to start with a bit of a general background on data because I think that there's a little bit of a misconception of what we consider data to be and exactly what we can do with the data that's available. And after a little bit of background, I'll move more into whether it's actually useful in some of the projects I've been working on. One being the one that Bob mentioned, the Integrated Status and Effectiveness Monitoring Program, and the other one being the Restoration Tracking Database over at NOAA Fisheries. And then finally, I'll end with a little bit more direction about data management and directions to go, lessons we've learned, that kind of thing. And, whoops, try to catch my breath. I ran across the parking lot. All right, so what is data? Data is essentially any kind of observations that we make within the world. So whether it's numbers, whether it's words, whether it's images, it's all of this together. And we have to do something with that data to actually turn it into information or knowledge. And I think that sometimes people use those terms interchangeably, that once we have data, we have knowledge. But really, once you have data, it's just the beginning. And being able to draw conclusions from that information or from the data to make information is really where we're going with everything. And in the Pacific Northwest, and actually in any kind of system, there's all kinds of data that are available to us. And being in environmental sciences and forest resources, we tend to hone in on a couple specific types of projects. You've got monitoring data that's out there. You've got restoration data. Project-specific information that we're collecting. From those projects, there are specific subtypes of projects. Normally, these have to do with status and trend monitoring, so trying to look for trends over time. And even at the small scale of time, like doing graduate projects for just a year or two, that still can be a form of status and trend monitoring. Another kind of project is effectiveness and implementation monitoring. And these have to do more with trying to detect change related to a specific action that was done and whether the action that was done was actually effective in the job that it was supposed to do. An implementation is a type of monitoring data that we actually don't see a whole lot of. It's basically if you do any kind of action, like a restoration action or improving an area, trying to change, it's monitoring whether that implementation is actually doing its job. So, for example, if you put a weir in a stream, is that weir still holding up after a year? Or what's the lifespan of that weir that you've put in the stream? And then the last kind is it's more project-level information. You know, how many projects are where, what kinds of things are happening, and where we can go from there. So then we can think about some more project-level details in the actual data generator. So you think about how many different agencies there are out there, how many individuals that are actually generating data. It's everywhere. And starting to think about the scale of the different projects. We have data being generated at the watershed scale or within streams, and then we have data being generated across entire states for statewide monitoring programs. And then we have different project designs that are put into place. So whether it's a before-after control impact design, a randomized design, very specific kinds of designs where it's not really random, but you're really trying to detect change when a specific action goes into place. Then we have different data types. And we have spatial data these days with GIS. It's everywhere. You've got whether you've got data coming in through data loggers, you've got data coming in through GIS applications, you've got data that you're just pulling off maps, tabular data, that's everything we're collecting in the field. So measuring things in the stream, measuring trees, all of that is data that just gets transferred as numbers. Data formats. We've got annual reports that could be considered a type of data generation. We've got different projections of data. We've got different kinds of management of data, but different formats like text files, databases, Excel. And then we've got lots of survey types. We've got data about fish and habitat and water quality and trees, time frame, data that is collected over multiple years, very single years, and different kinds of collection methods. So, you know, somebody wants to collect habitat information a certain way, somebody else needs to do it a different way to meet different objectives. So when you put all this together, it's a lot of data. There's a lot of information that's out there. And if we kind of break it down just in a couple general, very conservative assumptions for, if we just take, say, the state of Washington, let's say there's three data generators that were considered part of this. Two project types, three survey types, two project designs, 10 years. That says two data types, five data formats, five collection methods, 10 basins in Washington State. That's 180,000 files of data to deal with. And I would wager to say that most of that is happening independently because everybody feels that their project is specific to their needs, that many other people's data out there, because it wasn't collected with the same sort of objective in mind, it doesn't fit their purpose, and so they need to generate even more data. And this can become overwhelming. To me, that's a very scary number to think that there's that much data, and that's very conservative. And to think that, can't we do something with all of that? That all of that has already been generated and it's just waiting. So in order to think a little bit more about, okay, well, what would you have to do to actually put those data sets together? There's a bit of a data acquisition process that's a bit different than what you would do in the field, although it's kind of in parallel, but with a different slant on it. So there's this idea that there's truth out there, that we're collecting information about projects that are in the field, they're already done. Those projects get turned into reports, and we develop source data sets from those projects. So at the end of the day, you can imagine that every project that happens ends up with an end data set that is associated with that project. Those collected data sets, we can pull all of those together, and then we have to compare them. So here we've taken projects that are sort of very specific to their watershed, specific to their objective, and we've tried to align them into, okay, all of these projects are looking at information about restoration in streams. And then what we can do is we can actually migrate all of those data sets to a similar format, because then we can actually determine what parts of those data sets are even comparable to one another. Because often you find that when you're looking at these different studies that were done in parallel, since everybody has their own objectives in mind, you kind of get compartmentalized data that you don't really know how those data sets relate to one another. So with that in mind, we can think about, well, where is all of this data? You know, it doesn't seem to be readily available, or else I feel like a lot more people would be using the data that's already out there. And some of it is used. It's not altogether lost in space, but there are regional databases. EPA has a historic database and a current database. A lot of us probably use USGS real-time data. I'm a little bit fish-centric, so I apologize to the tree people, but I'm sure there are similar systems for forests. There's another one called Data Access Real-Time, which is actually run out of the University of Washington that tracks fish. There's Patagas, which is another fish database. There are metadata portals for spatial data. So there are these generalized areas that we can go to find the data, as well as the literature. That's probably what we're most commonly going to find information. But that's usually summarized information, so it's one step farther to go and find that raw data set that belongs with the literature. But by far, I think we could all raise our hands and say that We all, as data generators and collectors, possess a lot of data that just sits on our desktops, sits in our filing cabinets, sits in our computers, unfinished projects, finished projects that haven't gotten compiled with other projects, and it's in our own possession. And in a way, that makes for a very difficult system to try and share that information with others. And it becomes a legacy effect where we're sharing data by word of mouth, by who you know, by what programs you're involved with, and it's not readily available for anybody who doesn't really know, who's not part of that crowd or group that you participate in regularly. So to me, this is a coordination slide, but kind of reminds me of how this whole system works, because each one of these entities here is an agency, and every agency is collecting its own piece of data for their own system, and they all think they have it worked out for themselves, but when we try to look at something at a different scale than what they're interested in, all of a sudden this maybe doesn't make sense because everything overlaps, some things are going here, some things are going over there, and it becomes a more complicated puzzle to try and put together. So what do we do with the data? And I gave a little bit of an overview of this. The basic idea when you're working with large amounts of existing data sets is to collect the data, compile it, deal with formatting issues, deal with data definitions and crosswalking. You migrate data into a desired format. Then you can finally summarize it, analyze it, and draw conclusions from it. Easier said than done. So with a general background of where all this information is coming from, I'd like to now talk a little bit more about, well, is this actually useful? So I'm going to walk through three basic examples, one being a study that we've done in the John Day Basin for ISEM. Another one is a data dictionary project that kind of crosses over a little bit into ISEM but is NOAA-specific. And then another piece that we've done in just trying to utilize this information for project coordination. So as I kind of alluded to, there's a lot of disparate data sets that are out there, and our management implications are really occurring at much larger scales. So in the world of fish, we're concerned with ESA listings of species. And these ESA delineations and ESU delineations, which are basically groups of endangered salmonids, they cover a very large spatial scale. So we have to deal with the entire state of Washington, and Washington and Oregon and Idaho working together to try and figure out the status of their entire population. And these are very large-scale questions. And the population boundaries aren't drawn around watersheds. They're not drawn around agency boundaries or land management implications at all. And so here we have this problem of we're trying to answer a question that's at a very large spatial scale, but everybody that's working on projects within these basins is working on very specific questions that are occurring at a smaller spatial scale. So we're faced with this question of if we really want to try to answer questions that are related to salmonid species and status at the population level, then we have to compile those different pieces of information together to try and make sense of them. So this is one of the objectives of the project that I've been working on for the past couple of years, and it's called the Integrated Status and Effectiveness Monitoring Program. And our basic project goal is to develop a process for creating and evaluating monitoring programs. So with the idea in mind that we have to manage very spatially large populations of fish, how can we coordinate and evaluate and create principles that every agency could take a piece of or be involved with at a smaller spatial scale, still meet their own agency needs for their own project restoration goals or property goals, but at the same time become a part of something bigger? Because the question that we're really trying to answer at the ESA level is at a much larger scale than what those agencies are used to working at. And even this is something that has even come up in Congress. For the sake of all of the biological opinion money that has come from Congress that's directly going to Bonneville Power and agencies to try and restore habitat. They want to know if it's working. And no one really knows, because the projects that we're implementing right now are at such a small spatial scale that the impacts that they might have and that we're looking for are a larger spatial scale. So that's kind of the basis of our project. And some of the specific things that we've been working on in three pilot basins. So all this work is taking place in the John Day watershed in Oregon. Then there's the Wenatchee and actually also the Eniat in Washington. And then the Lemhi and the South Fork of the Salmon over in Idaho. And these are kind of the different categories of things that we're attacking for trying to develop these monitoring programs. So there's experimental designs. There's developing metrics and indices. There's how can we maybe supplement existing monitoring programs to make it more useful at that larger spatial scale. Can we design programs that monitor different life stages of fisheries, and also look at different kinds of habitat variables that are maybe acting at different spatial scales. And as we've started to go through this process, what we realized that was kind of the glue that was holding things together was our data management and how we can collect information to support all of these ideas that we're trying to develop. We've got to do something with that data to make it useful for other people. One of my first objectives whenever I joined this program as my postdoc was, my boss said to me, well, we've got a lot of data in the John Day Basin, so why don't you go collect it all and see what we can do with it and assess the status of the data, what's there, how much is there, who's got it, and pull it all together and draw some conclusions about what we need to do to supplement that monitoring study. So being really naive, I said, okay, sure, no problem. So I compiled data, I summarized data as much as I could, and we tried to figure out some of these data gaps, and we still have yet to get to the offer direction to monitoring programs, but we're trying, we're getting there. So what we did was I set out to collect all of this historic data in the John Day Basin. So there's been data that's been collected there since about 1985 for water quality, and their fish records go back to about 1950. I spent probably 80 hours in a three-month period just on the phone, talking to people, chasing down leads, reading reports, really just trying to get my hands on the data itself. And I thought I was doing pretty well once I got the data in my hands, and then I realized that I had to do something with the data to make it work together. And so myself and somebody else spent, you know, hundreds of hours just processing data and reformatting it. And since then, we've spent, I would say, another couple thousand of hours filling in metadata information about that project, because most of the time whenever we collect project information or collect data from other agencies, you're getting the raw data. You're getting the numbers that somebody collected in the field, but very rarely is the information about the project, why they started the project, how they did the project, where their sites were, how often they resampled those sites. That information is all stored in an annual report or a proposal, someplace very separate from the data itself. So what we found was a large quantity of historic data, multiple data types that were out there. Nothing was consistent, and there was no central data storage within the agencies. So even within agencies, it was a matter of calling multiple people to try and track down the data. And so this is just a snapshot of kind of what that turned out to be. We ended up spending most of our time on stream temperature data, and there's over 30,000 temperature records, because water quality data is usually collected on water temperature loggers. So you can take hourly data, so it's very quickly to, you can very quickly get a lot of data for very few sites. When we started this, there were probably about 15 agencies that were collecting data in the John Day Basin. 20 years of data, 300 locations, and there was no coordination. You would talk to people and they would even say that, oh yeah, well, so-and-so, their logger is probably 100 feet from mine. I don't know why they put one out, but I put mine out here every year. So we would get a lot of replication in the data that we were even collecting. And so what we've done is taken all of this data and put it into a single database to manage that water quality data set. So we've gone from having messy field data, where there's a large volume, multiple data types, multiple sources, multiple formats, and tried to turn it into something that could be used for regional data analysis. Centralized source, standardized formats, metadata is included, processing tools, summary and analysis can now happen with that data set. What we've ended up developing, and I'll talk more about these later, is that there really is a data management strategy that you can pull together to manage your data. And it doesn't matter whether you're working at a very small scale or a very large scale. At some point, to make your data useful for someone else, there are certain pieces of information that we have to attach to that data set. And I'll talk a little bit more about these tools later. So the second example of trying to coordinate and pull together existing data to use for regional analyses comes from a habitat tracking database that has been developed at NOAA Fisheries. And the major goal of this database, I guess, was to look at restoration projects. So instead of looking at monitoring observation data, this was trying to take project-level information and assess how many projects have been implemented in the Pacific Northwest for as long as there are records to document it. And again, they were going for this question or working at the scale of if we're trying to recover salmon, that is a larger analysis scale than what these projects are typically implemented for. But can we roll up the information of the individual projects and make it useful at a larger scale? We kind of considered this a bottom-up approach to how this was done. We started looking at databases that were already available. So there are ones for OWEB and Surfboard and PacSurf. And basically, these are large-scale regional databases of funders that have to keep track of all of their projects that they implement. So this project pulled information from these large-scale databases and pulled it all together. There were also federal and state private data sources that were looked at. And they tried to get all the information possible about these sites. So what kind of project was implemented there, the spatial location, name of the project, the people that were conducting the work, whether there was monitoring done. And then there were some assessments that had to be made about, okay, well, what information from every project is consistent enough that we could use them across projects and pull them together. And with that, they created a set of crosswalks to be able to map one agency's data or one database's data to another database. So this is what it looks like. It's called the Pacific Northwest Salmon Habitat Project Database. And this has over, I think they're up to 40,000 projects now and that have taken place across the whole Pacific Northwest. And all of the colors on this map, so those are all dots, and all of the colors on those dots are representing the different project types that were implemented. So the project types that they created were their data dictionary for being able to crosswalk one agency's data to another agency's data. They were given a generalized category. And there are a lot of directions that you can take this data now that it's assembled, because here we now have a catalog of all of the restoration projects that have been implemented in the Northwest. You can look at funding. You can look at agency. Who's doing what? When are these projects being implemented? How long does it take them to be put into action? And so that kind of leads into the last example that I just wanted to quickly go over, which is trying to coordinate restoration and monitoring projects. The first database that I talked about, or project ISEM, is working with collecting monitoring data, actual observational data from the field. The second database that we're working with is restoration project information. And the next and final step that this is sort of in is, well, can you put those two things together? Because technically, you should be able to use your restoration projects to inform where there might be projects that need to happen because there's a lack of projects in the area. And you can also use the monitoring data to assess whether the projects are actually becoming effective. So we've taken those kinds of issues into consideration for several of the monitoring designs that ISEMP is helping to coordinate in both the Eniat Basin and also the John Day Basin. So it's this idea of, we've created these catalogs of restoration work. We have catalogs now of the monitoring data. So let's put them together so that whenever we decide where we're going to put sites next year and collect more information, that we're not replicating the information we already have, but instead we're supplementing. So these are just a couple maps, and they're basically showing that all of the numbers are the actual projects that were implemented, and the dots are referring to where the water temperature loggers have been placed for the year. And we're making one big assumption, I guess, in all of this, in trying to use project-level data to summarize, evaluate, pull together, and to use for regional data analyses. And there's a big question about this, of whether we should actually even use it. Because we're making a lot of assumptions about all of these projects that you have to consider whenever you're trying to overlap study designs and different data sets. So these are some of the questions that sort of have to come up in your mind as you're thinking about data. What information is available about the data? Can you translate it? Can you create a crosswalk? What was the study design? You know, did somebody go out there and collect data very purposefully in a certain way? What was the purpose of the study? You know, if you're going out there trying to just count fish to see how many fish are there, that's a very different objective than if you're trying to go out there and figure out how many fish are going down over the Bonneville Dam and coming back. And you only want to look at juveniles, and you only want to look at cutthroat trout. Or not cutthroat, but steelhead. The assumptions that we make about our study designs and all of this, and saying like, well, it's data, we can just use that all together. Instead, we could actually be violating a lot of very basic rules in how that data was collected, because there's bias that's associated with it. There's always the question of data density, and I think that this is the one that people probably think about the most whenever they're going out there to collect more data, and that, well, there isn't exactly the right set of data that I need, so I need to collect my own. And if you've done a good assessment of the data for the region that you're looking at, then that could very well be the case, that you need to supplement the existing information with additional information. And then the quality of the data. Was it a whole bunch of field techs that don't even know what kind of fish or tree is out there, and you have them identifying things in the field? Or was it a professional that's been doing this for 20 years collecting the information? The quality that's associated with the data can be very different in those two different scenarios. And then how long does it take to actually assemble the data? If you're looking at hundreds of thousands of spreadsheets to deal with, it's a significant amount of time that you have to spend digging through other people's file cabinets to figure it out. This is an example about, I think, that demonstrates well this idea of bias in how data is collected, and how one person's view of the data and another person's view of the data and how that data is used can produce very different conclusions whenever those two data sets are analyzed. So what we did with the restoration database is that there was a crosswalk that related two high-level databases together. That crosswalk had, there was one for NRRSS, can't remember what that one stands for, and PACSURF, and we used the crosswalk between those two databases that was used to create ours to break down the number of projects that were by category type. So what we have here is we have two data dictionaries from two different sources. Let's see, so this is water quality management right here for NRSS. So this is the number of projects and the cost that were categorized in the data dictionary of this database to be $12,000. If we look at PACSURF for their water quality projects, so this is the same set of projects and we just translated them into two different data dictionaries. The same set of projects were assessed at having an average value of $228,000 versus $12,000. So when you're trying to go through at a management level and assessing, like, well, do we need to put more water quality projects in? If you look at this one, you look, hey, well, we did quite a few projects. It only cost $12,000, so we could do lots of those. Whereas if you're looking at this database, you think, well, we didn't do very many of them, and they were really expensive. So why? We need to carefully consider whether this is something that we should be doing down the road. And this is all just an artifact of somebody's data dictionary, of a category that they assigned to some project information. And another way of using this restoration data is to think that, well, did we actually address what the need was in the basin? Because supposedly, whenever we implement projects, we should be addressing, you know, you go out there, you assess the environment, you decide this is the problem, and then you treat that problem. Just like you would when you go to the doctor's office. There's a diagnosis of a problem, you get a treatment, and then you have a follow-up exam to make sure that that treatment actually was successful. So it's the same idea here. Do we have cases like this, these two cases, I guess, where in this case, the habitat assessment in blue was greatly over-cured or over-treated by the number of projects that were implemented to assess that. And same here. Is this just wasted money? I mean, are we even doing anything because we don't even think it's that much of a problem there, and yet we're dumping in twice as much money in projects to try and solve this problem that might not even exist. And this is a similar problem in stream habitat and accessibility that's in the other example. How does all this happen? I mean, how could we have such a disconnect between the information that's being collected and what our problems actually are? You know, we all start out with this workflow that we've got a question in mind, we develop a strategy to figure out the answer, we develop some protocols and methodology to answer that question, we go out in the field, we collect data, we enter the data, we store it, and then we share it. From here, we create a lot of metadata. So there's a lot of project-level information about each one of our data sets that more than likely is just kind of inherent about it. Yes, I was trying to figure out how many trees, the species richness of a certain stand of trees, and these are the trees that I was looking at, and all of that is just metadata information. We can do these for... or all of this can be created into local analyses, agency-level analysis, and regional-level analyses. And we produce reports. We're very good at producing reports. Summaries of what's going on in this basin at this time. This is what we're going to do about it to manage it. And then we try to evaluate the system, figure out what's going on. And in the process of pulling together historic information and try to make sense of it, what we really realize is that there are some very big gaps in this workflow that are pretty much overlooked, because we sort of assume that it's working, that we're going through this process, everybody at their own individual level is walking through these pieces. When we start to look at it, there are three probably fundamental areas that are broken. So the first idea is a monitoring protocol. It's the idea that you write down exactly what you did to be able to go out and replicate the same project or experiment in the field. And storing that metadata with your data set. And what we often found in going and talking to agencies is that people have reference materials, but they don't necessarily have a specific protocol to what they're working on. So, for example, someone says, oh, I'm going to collect habitat data. And you say, okay, well, what's your methodology? How are you going to collect that habitat information? And they say, well, I'm going to use the EMAP protocol. Okay, well, are you doing exactly EMAP? And they say, well, for the most part, I mean, I'm going to change a little bit this because it doesn't quite fit my needs, and I'm going to, you know, just tweak this a little bit, but I'm pretty much doing EMAP. Okay? And you ask somebody else, and they say the same thing. And what you start to find is that there's this idea of a monitoring protocol, but it actually comes down to very few studies that are actually documenting every change that they make within the protocol, because those changes that you make within your protocol will then produce bias into your project and your data that are important things that the next person might want to know. It's the same reason why all of us have this tendency to want to collect information that's our own, because we know how we did it. Data gap that exists is this idea of data entry and data storage. I have a quick question for everyone. So how many people feel like they've been taught or are being taught how to collect data? Show of hands. Collect data. You feel like you could go out in the field and successfully grab some data. Okay, what about managing that data? All right, a couple people. So there's this idea that we're collecting data, and that's what we're trained to do, but we're not really trained to manage data. We're trained to get as much information as we can, but there's a hole here that you collect it, but then what happens to it? It dissipates into a journal article, which is great. That's part of the story for sure, is informing for future decisions. But it kind of is a dead end for your data set if it's not able to easily participate in other experiments. And so I think we're dealing with a cultural shift here. We're all trained to go through this process to collect data, but we're not trained to actually figure out how to manage that data and pass that information on to other people.
And in fact, it almost becomes this idea of storytelling.
You know, you kind of think of legends that are told throughout the years. Projects are almost stored in a very similar way. The best way to understand somebody's project is to talk to the person that actually did the study, because there's 10 or 15 things that might be important to what you're looking at that are only housed with that person. And it's
a lot of information to be storing in individual people, and trying to figure out ways to store and manage data that makes it easier to work with other data sets help us out a lot. So we've got disparate data dictionaries, we've got gaps in our data flows, there's objective issues, trying to keep up with the times because there are always new questions that are coming out, there's always new technology, there's always personnel changes, so it's an uphill battle. This is not an easy thing. So I'm going to try to go through this last section pretty quickly, but probably the most important one. But this idea of how do we make data more useful, right? We've got all these problems. We've got data sharing issues that if right now we're working in the left-hand side, everybody's data works with their own puzzle, but you can't really put those pieces together. So can we make our data more interoperable by documenting the data, using consistent formats and comparable methodologies? Because we're trying to address this idea of using small project-level information to be rolled up into regional data analyses. This is kind of the nuts and bolts of what we have to record with data sets, and it's kind of like the wish list. You know, what do you want to know about a piece of data that lands on your desk? You want to know why they collected it, the sampling design, the metric, the indicator, how they did it, the protocol, the method, all of the pieces of information. You want those defined so that you can use it appropriately. And the last thing that we're actually trying to manage is the observed data. So how do we do it? We've got data dictionaries. I mean, it's a simple idea that every attribute or piece of information that you collect should be defined, should have a set of units on it, should be able to, if you could look it up in the dictionary, it would say exactly what that is. The idea of a sampling design, recording your sampling design and storing it with your data set. Did you use a random sample? Did you stratify by a certain variable because it was confounding in your study? Keeping track of these pieces of information will make it much more useful for somebody else. Same with protocols, methods. How many of you have dealt with, you know, a data set that lands on your desk that has codes in it and you don't know what the codes mean? That's a very simple problem. It's a data dictionary problem. And when you actually are managing the tabular data itself, putting it into a normalized structure. So that basically means putting your data in a structure that will communicate with somebody else's data set. And that's really a question for a database designer. You know, all of us are trained as biologists. Some of the tools that we've been working with have started to create these normalized structures that are more accessible to biologists. We're basically not trained to have these tools available to us. And then finally, geodatabases, which are on the spatial side of things. You know, this last part is just going through some of the tools that we've created. Basically, how to we've got tools to manage protocols and the actual observational data, and we can store observational data from habitat studies, from water quality studies, from fish surveys. And all of that gets stored into the same structure. And what that does, it makes it very easy to translate data between projects. So I think with that, I'll probably just cut it off.
Metadata. Uh-huh. One of the problems with USGS, US Geological Survey, is that the metadata are so complicated that to actually complete them would take hiring a whole new person. And so there's that problem of balancing the complexity of metadata.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I think the complexity of metadata, it's kind of the bottom line of probably why we don't do it, because there's probably a little bit of, well, we don't know how, but the other part is there's a lot of information to record. You know, your sampling designs, everything that you collect has a definition. To me, it seems like we've got to have some sort of middle ground where you've got essential pieces of information that have to be entered as your metadata. You need to have a sampling design. You can't separate that from the information itself. You should be able to define everything that you've collected. That maybe there's a very minimal set of things that we could agree on, because otherwise it does become completely overwhelming, for sure.